irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the show. Oh, boy, my headphones is loud. Okay, there we go. Good morning. Welcome to the show. Today is finally Friday, and I love Fridays here. The date is September 20th, and for those of you wondering where Orr is, she went on vacation last week, so she's going to be on a cruise for about a week. So we're going to be here and having fun, and hopefully we're going to continue to have some great guests joining us and continue to have great shows. I'm honored to have Director Paul Camp in the studio. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And before we get into the business, I wanted to ask you, did you hear about this Delta flight that plunged 30,000 feet in about 7 minutes?
I did not.
You didn't hear about
that
one.
You're telling me about it right now.
I'm telling you about it right now. It's in the news. And I saw this yesterday, and I thought, you know, do you like flying?
I do. I travel.
You see,
much.
I used to love flying, and now I don't anymore because of things like this.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I mean, dropping that that far that quick.
Yeah.
You're sure you're gonna die, right?
Yeah. I assume they didn't.
Yeah. Well, no, they didn't.
Okay. Good.
They ended up landing. They sort of like straightened it about, I think, 10,000 feet or so. That's close.
Yeah.
That's very close. And so I'm just looking at this. I'm going, I don't know if I want to get on a plane again, you know. And I always do that. And I'm definitely not taking long flights anymore, you know. I used to fly 14 hours to Europe, and that's too much.
I'll think of that next time I get on a plane.
Good. I just wanted
Thanks
to make sure.
That.
Exactly. I wanted to make sure that you feel confident about your flights. Welcome to the show, Paul. You're the director of the film Imprisoned, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. I wanted to know a little bit about you. Are you an LA native?
No, I grew up in northern Minnesota.
Oh, really?
Way up in the woods.
Not many people come from there, right?
No, right where Bob Dylan grew up.
Really?
Yeah, right by him. So,
but at least you had nice nature there,
nice
right?
Nice nature, cold. And lakes and fishing and all of that.
Yeah, very
stuff.
Cold,
so,
right?
Yeah. So that's where I came from and ended up in Chicago for about 10 years after graduate school, and then been out in L.A. about 15 years now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Where did you go to graduate school in?
Illinois State University.
Oh, okay. So, that's pretty cool, right? What did you take there?
I did my master's in acting. So that was my. That's where all the people from Steppenwolf Theater came out of Illinois State. So I came after them, and then moved my theater company up from Normal, Illinois, up to Chicago for 10 years.
Oh, so you had a theater company?
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. That was my background. Yeah.
Oh, what does that mean? A theater company? What do you guys do?
We did original work, so all of the productions we put together were new plays by new writers. So we I built a couple theaters in Chicago, and so we would develop the plays, produce them, and you know run an art center in Chicago. And then my first movie was a film adaptation of a play of mine. So that's sort of what got me into the industry that I'm stuck in.
Wow, is this what you always wanted to do? Where did you go for undergrad?
I went to the University of Minnesota Duluth.
Okay,
which is just as cold as where I grew up.
Yeah, I've heard of Duluth. As
Yeah, it's a very cold place. I went there for acting. That was my background.
I see. And so you knew pretty much early on where you wanted to go.
Yeah, I discovered it when I was in college. I was a music major, but then I saw a play and I kind of fell in love with it. So that's what moved me in that direction.
So you're definitely the creative type.
For better or for worse.
Yeah, you can't sit in an office 9 to 5, right?
Not trying.
That would kill you, right?
Yeah.
I know what that's like, man.
Yeah.
Very cool. So, you know, early on you wanted to be an actor, and you actually took it seriously. You went to school and everything. And so the theater company, did you start it all by yourself?
I had two fellows with me in graduate school, and we started it when my first year of graduate school. And then it became very successful, so most of my graduate work was running my own company.
Really?
Yeah, so that was, we were too successful too quick, and it was luck and arrogance and all of those things. But
wow.
it kind of cemented for me what I wanted to do, was create new work all the time.
Very cool. So you were there for a while in Chicago.
Yeah.
And then you moved here to L.A.
Yeah, I did a I made a film of a play of mine that was in Chicago and ended up shooting it in Salt Lake City, Utah, with Patrick Wilson and John Hurt and Neil McDonough. It was a great cast. And then the film got around, and suddenly I was a writer, director, filmmaker, and I had to kind of adjust my brain to that.
Yeah.
And then I got to Los Angeles for post-production, and then as it happens, people start meeting you, they see your work, and all of a sudden doors seem to open, and then you have to find a way to reopen them.
Right, exactly. They don't open for everyone, but you came pretty prepared. I mean, you've had some work under your belt, you know. And so forth. So people knew you, they were talking to someone serious.
Yeah, I mean, I think I came here as a little bit older and a little less starry-eyed, but it still doesn't prepare you for what this town is.
Really? Which is what?
A lot of promises that don't come out to be true, a lot of people who have different agendas, and, you know, everyone out here is hustling. So, you know,
trying to get the same jobs, right?
Yeah, same jobs or create your own jobs. I always say LA to me is like, it's still like the Wild West. You decide what you are. And if you do it, then that's what you are.
I see.
But no one really checks if you're the sheriff. You just arrest people, and they treat you like the sheriff. So, you know, yeah. It's a kind of a very weird place to...
I know. The Wild West was pretty weird. You know, I mean, people would just take the law into their hands. You know, I got a gun. You know, just look at me the wrong way, and I'm going to shoot you.
Yeah. And that's a good metaphor for this town.
Yeah, that's true, right? Yeah, I never thought of it that way. Yeah. But it definitely takes a lot of connections and knowing people to get to where you want to be.
Yeah, I think it's really about 4 years here. I do a lot of teaching of actors, and I always say, you know, it takes about 3 to 4 years before you really understand how the town works and you really get to know people. And you can have opportunities that go well, but it really is a marathon. You have to really be committed to your work for the long term. And you can't just come out for 6 months or a year and think you're going to, you know, build a career or make a decision about can you build a career. You have to commit, and you'll have your ups and downs, you know, all the way through.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that does strike me when people come down here and they think they're going to make it and everything, like really quickly. Yeah. But they don't realize there's a long line already. You know, get in line, take a number.
Yeah, and the line doesn't like letting you in either.
No.
Because they've been sitting around for a long time.
Exactly. So
it's like any business. You have to find your way to elbow your way in and show that you have something to offer. And then, and then you know, once you can hopefully provide a service to people, then you're valuable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like you said, you know, if you can't find the job you want, then you make it.
Mm-hmm.
You make it. By yourself,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's what you did.
Yeah.
So, but when you first came into town, what was it like for you? I mean, was it like a culture shock for you?
It was, you know, I'll tell you, it seemed pretty magical at first because it's beautiful and you know, you go from coffee shop to coffee shop and you meet with people and it seems magical.
And they're all beautiful.
They're all beautiful. Yeah. You know, I came out here and I had a partner or I had an investment at the time that was going to back what I was doing. And that money got diverted to another person through some Hollywood ways. And I found myself out here sort of, you know, alone, you know, and you have to start over. And and that's sort of what made me, you know, build what I'm doing today and building my training program. And a lot of the work I do is really based on trying to make sure that you can protect your own work.
Right.
You know, it's hard to depend on, you know, other people.
That's true, right? People would steal your work, no problem.
Yeah, or they, you know, everyone out here is hustling hard to eat. And so, you know, and I used to get angry and realize everyone here is trying to climb. And so, you know, myself included, you just have to hopefully find a good circle of people you can trust.
Right. And you know, hopefully you'll be doing what you love to do, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because I'm starting to reexamine my life, really. I've lived here about 42 years, right?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking...
Where from?
Israel.
Yeah.
So I came from Israel. I was 16. I landed in Vegas because that's where I had some family. I lived the second part of the 70s in Vegas.
Yeah.
And then I moved here. So... But I'm realizing, you know, I mean, I have a radio station. I've done it for 12 years. I'm successful and everything. But I'm realizing, what am I doing this for, you know? I mean, so I worked so hard to sustain the lifestyle that I created, which I don't necessarily need. You know, I don't need to live in a, you know, an expensive house and have a Mercedes and all this, but I do because that's what it takes to feel good in L.A., whatever it is, but at least for me. So I've seen the other side. You know, I've traveled out of the state, and I see people doing great things, and you can live for half the price. So I thought, you know, maybe I'll go live over there, and my expenses will be half, and I'll work half as hard, you know? Because, come on, I mean, we're chasing our tails here, you know? But you're in a place, I mean, you're in an industry, your profession is where you actually create things and stuff, so you can see what happens, and you have a body of work, you know? So how did you, so then you got into what, into directing?
Yeah, I had made that first film, and I'd written a lot for the theater as an actor, and primarily actor-writer. And then as I adapted this film, the first film I did and I directed, I started writing more for the screen, and it got attention, and a lot of the writing I had was doing was getting people interested, and you know, which is fantastic, but you realize then you have to do all the work to get it from interested to financed and made. But I really focused on what I did in Chicago is I had a theater company. I did a lot of training, a lot of teaching of acting. So I started doing that out here as my way of staying connected to the process.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think a lot of the time you can get caught up in chasing your tail and and have an idea or a project that's moving and it hits a wall for 2 years. So I found it very difficult not to be working with actors. So I built a school, and I do that in between production. I work with a lot of you know, actors who've made the move here, and a lot of well-known actors that that work with me, which is really great. And I think to this day, I've been able to cast over 100 actors that work with me in the films I've done. So I try to give them opportunities to get their first, you know, on-camera experience or, you know, at least take advantage of having that bridge between training and production.
So how many students approximately do you have at one time?
Well, I probably have worked with about 350 actors here in L.A.
But at a time.
I work, when I do classwork, it's 10 maximum.
I see, okay. So,
I
you
keep
have,
it very, very small.
Yeah, so you have attention to, you can pay attention to everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Yeah. That's pretty cool. So how long have you had the training?
Yeah, primarily about within the first year of moving out here, I became kind of desperate to, I got to do this. So I started doing, I was asked to go in and teach some places that knew me. And then pretty quickly I was approached to do some private coaching, and then I just opened my own studio. So it's about 13 years I've been doing
that. Oh, wow. Yeah. So you've been doing this for a while now. Yeah, very cool. And then along with that, you've been making films too, right?
Yeah.
How many have you made so far?
Features of six.
Wow.
Six and probably 18 short films.
Wow.
Something like that, yeah.
And everybody knows you can't do this by yourself, right?
Yeah.
So how did you start connecting with the right people?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I got out here having made my first film and realized that it's very hard to make any second, third, fourth film. And speaking of this group, I took a group of eight actors that were in one of my classes, and I wrote a film for them. And I said, we're going to make this film, and I don't want you to put any money in, but I'm going to find the money.
Right.
I called in all the favors I had, and it was about a $300,000 film, and I got it down to $25,000 of real money. And I had a director of photography I had met. I hadn't worked with him, but we'd gotten to know each other, and he owned his cameras and sound. And I approached him. I said, look, this is a crazy idea. Let's rehearse this. Let's shoot this in 5 days. And he came on board, and I got the $25,000 investment from someone that I said, you'll never get your money back. This is small, unknown group of actors.
Yeah.
But we shot the film, and it won some several film festivals and got actors' attention and gave them footage for their reels, and that started the process. So once I made this film years ago with this DP, he shot my last movie. We've shot probably 15 or 16 projects together, and that allows me to have this team.
Right.
You know, whether we do a big film or we do a small film, it's really the same core team, and they understand sometimes it's $100 a day and sometimes it's more.
Right.
So it's more of a theater approach to making film than I think tends to generally happen, because I have an ensemble of people that get together and we make something, whether it's tiny or bigger, it's the core of the same people working.
Right. Yeah. And they create work for themselves too. You know what I mean? Whether you make a lot of money or not, you're building your resume, you know, your experience, you know, you actually get to to act in a real film.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that people forget in this industry, or maybe not forget, they have a hard time with, is you have to just keep doing.
Right.
Whether you're acting or writing or directing, you have to find a way to continue to do it, even if it's very small scale, because you learn from the process of inertia. And a lot of times as actors I will work with, they won't have an audition for 3 months, and they think they're working, but they're really just doing nothing with their instrument. So I think you always have to keep working on something.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. What do you your first film? What was that like for you? What was it called?
It's called Brothers 3, and it you can find it out somewhere. It's still out, out on DVD and Blu-ray. But it was an amazingly jarring experience, because as a first-time director, it doesn't matter. I've helped a lot of first-time directors now, and I always say, you're going to have ideas that are completely right, but no one will trust you because you've never directed. Right. And you'll have crazy ideas that you think are right, and they're completely wrong. and I went through that process. I was directing a film version of a play, and I had played the lead in the play for 16 weeks on stage. So now directing it, I knew the story, but I didn't understand truly how you really change storytelling from film, from stage to film.
Yeah.
That's a visual medium, and the story was written. It was a very successful play, but it was language driven, and so that was the hard transition to realize. Even in the shoot, you can feel this scene is longer than it needs to be for a film, and then you get into post production. So I always say that process was another graduate school, because you really learn in post production what filmmaking is.
Yeah, that's
and having not been in post, I finished the film. I remember this specifically. I finished the film, and I thought, okay, we shot it. It's great, and now I realize, oh, I have 8 months.
Yeah.
And I was used to putting up a play. It closes, you have a party, it's done.
Right.
But then I realized that's when you learn how to direct, is that you're in post, and you realize what you didn't need and what you should have gotten. And to me, when I work with young directors, I say, take your iPhone, shoot a 10-minute movie, go edit it with an editor or yourself, and you'll figure out a lot about what a film is by being in post-production.
Right. And that's what many people don't realize. You know, they think the filming is the major part of it.
Right.
But essentially, you're creating your assets for you. Then you go into the studio.
Yeah.
And then you put the pieces together.
Yeah.
You
rewrite your film in post-production. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where you actually create the film.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, put it together and get the idea of how things should be. And that's why I think editors are underrated, you know,
absolutely.
Because they do a tremendous job too, and they work closely with you. I mean, does an editor have any autonomy to make decisions on their own, or is it pretty much you just sit there and you tell them what to do?
No, I think, you know, it depends on the director and the editor. I believe in, you know, letting the editor take the raw footage, and they have the script and they have the order, and they present something initially. And the director responds. A lot of times there are things you hadn't thought of that you have to adjust to because it's new. I have worked with editors where I sit in the room the whole time. And I don't find that to be as effective for the editor or myself, because there's nothing to try and show the director. He's right there.
Right.
And I think that there's a good balance. I think with this film, I had an editor in Puerto Rico I had never worked with before. And he worked on putting together the assembly of the film first. So when I watched it, I saw some of his take, his visual approach to it that I liked, and some that I felt we didn't need. And then you start finding a collaboration in the process. But editors are storytellers. They're filmmakers.
Right.
And they know what you need. And you know, ideally you get an editor involved in the shooting process, because they should be looking at your dailies.
That's
and
true.
Say, you know, you need an insert of that hand, or you need... Because there's nothing to cut to, and it's very important for a director who's not directed before to have an editor involved in the shooting.
That's true.
Just
makes
for
sense.
Pieces. You just need pieces, you know, at times. And that's often overlooked, is sometimes you don't need beautiful footage, you just need cuts.
Right.
You know, somewhere
exactly.
to go.
Exactly, yeah. But the collaboration part, that's the interesting part of this all. And so let's go. Okay, so you made a couple of other films. What were they about? They like Was I mean, you said Brothers 3,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So was there 1 and 2 also?
No. That was just a phrase in the movie that was the play was called American Gothic, but it was hard to get that play title in a film because I think there's 5,000
right.
films. So that was a line in the film that we decided on as the title. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So there was no 1 and 2, but
very
and now
cool.
Maybe I'll think of a prequel.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
And how about subsequent films?
Yeah, I mean,
did you feel you were growing with each movie?
Yeah, I mean, I think from that first film, I shot it on 35mm, which I don't know if I'll ever do again. And that was the whole experience of shooting 11 minutes at a time, and you run out of footage and things that you don't really think about. Now, digitally, just you can roll, and you're not going to run out of hard disk space. But making these smaller movies that I was talking about earlier, making these films with these talented, lesser-known actors with no money really was the best education because you're shooting very specifically, you're planning very calculatedly, you're rehearsing, you're making sure your camera crew and your cast are on the same page. So I made a film called From Grace, which was the small film I mentioned. And then I ended up doing something kind of, I think, a little bit crazy. Mm-hmm. I took, I think, about 60 actors and did 2 feature films, where one film was about 20 actors from that I work with, and the crew of that film were all the other actors from the other film. And then a week later, we reversed it.
Oh.
So we did a film called Amnesia, which did very well. Won in L.A., won a film festival here and some other places. And then another film called Brad's Untitled Restaurant Project, which is a comedy. But the idea was the crew from one was the cast for the other, and we shot 2 features in 2 weeks. And that was an amazing experience because it was all about putting in place how you can be economic and efficient in storytelling. Now, there was no explosions or car chases. It was
right.
actor pieces. But those kind of films led me to really lock into the way I tend to work, which is actor-driven, very specific. You know, I try to shoot this last film I did in prison. We ended a day shorter than the schedule.
Really?
You know, I think about $1 million under budget because I think of at least the way we work tends to be pretty efficient and drives things forward in a more concise way.
Yeah, so it helps to struggle in the beginning because then you get more creative.
Yeah, and I think you also get used to the fact that you're always struggling. That,
yeah,
you know,
right?
There's never it never gets easier. It's just the kind of struggle changes, you know, because you're dealing with new people and new circumstances and nothing ever goes the way you think. But at least you've been through the challenges to know that you'll get through it. You'll
yeah.
get through it, you know.
Yeah. Amazing. So, Paul, let's move forward to Imprison.
Sure.
And that's the film that was just released, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And where can people see it before we start talking
yeah,
about
well,
it?
Yeah, well, it opens in Los Angeles tonight at the Lemley Music Hall. It opens in Lakewood, California as well. And we open in Puerto Rico and New York, and now we're in L.A. and doing the tour. Happy to talk with you.
Yeah,
but,
thank you.
But it opens at 4:40, I think, today, and then at 7 o'clock tonight, and then there's a 10:30 at the Lemley. And I'll be attending with some cast members for a Q&A tonight after the 7 o'clock.
Oh, so if you guys are in L.A., there's something to do on a Friday afternoon.
Absolutely. Come see it. Come in the early evening and come say hi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the Lemley in Santa Monica, did you say?
No, Music Hall.
Music Hall. I see. Okay, well, all the Lemleys are nice,
yeah.
You know. So, Imprison, tell us what it's about. When did the idea come for you?
The idea came many, many years ago when I was in Chicago. I worked a little bit in the Cook County prison system doing some work with those incarcerated men and women, doing some workshops, and it really sort of planted the seed in me about, you know, where they were in their lives. And a lot of the men I talked to, you realized, you know, that they had a very bad day and now their life has changed forever. And that idea of punishment and rehabilitation was intriguing to me. So it kind of planted the seed about a story that had to do with someone who's paid their debt to society, but yet there's someone trying to keep them from living a free life.
Even after they get out,
even
right?
after they get out, yeah. So in this story, it's there's a main character, Juan Pablo Raba plays him. This is character of Dylan, who's paid his debt to society. He's come out. He has found love with this wonderful woman, Maria, played by Juana Costa, and they live an idyllic life in a fishing community in Puerto Rico. And there's a prison warden, played by Lawrence Fishburne, who was impacted by this man's past. And he won't let him go for what he did, and so he orchestrates based on the power he has in the prison system to pull him back into the system. And it's really an argument between philosophies: are you who you are today versus are you who you used to be? And those are the two arguments that are playing out in the movie.
Yeah. Sounds intriguing to me. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
Because, well, first of all, Lawrence Fishburne, that's a great get for you.
Yeah, I mean, I am very lucky that he read the script and responded, and was such a joy to work with, and to me, one of the greatest American actors living today. And the work he does in this movie is complicated and emotionally diverse, and it's really amazing.
So you got really lucky, right?
Yeah.
To get someone like him to play the character that you wanted.
Yeah, and we had a great collaboration. I know he had an amazing time in Puerto Rico. Who doesn't?
Right.
But it's a great cast. Edward James Olmos is in the cast. Isai Morales, John Huertas, John Hurd, as well. So it's a really, really wonderful eclectic cast. It's about 20% in Spanish and 80% in English. So we blend it organically and subtitle it when need be. But that was the other, you know, that was one of the wonderful things working with Lawrence, is that sometimes he'll speak in Spanish here and there, and he's able to do that and make it authentic to the Puerto Rican culture.
Wow. Now, did you write the film as well?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I wrote it, like I said, many years ago, and it sat as one of those projects that I wanted to do, and the time was right, and my partners in Equitas Entertainment, we started a company, and this was the way to do it, was to take this movie and apply some of our mission-driven work, which is equal pay for women. So we paid our female lead equal to her male counterpart. We made a commitment to giving back in the community of Puerto Rico as we made the movie. And so part of our company's mission is to not just make an entertaining, hopefully engaging film, but how we make the movie and how we honor diversity and honor equal pay, I think, is a lot of talk in Hollywood, but it's hard to find. It takes a risk financially to do it, to actually say we're going to take these steps and pay people equally and cost more money to the production because we believe it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is, when people do equal work, I can't even start to imagine why I would pay a woman less.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
If you're doing the same work, you're doing the same work, you know. No, but it's true, because I guess this is still a throwback to years when women were subservient or weren't in the workforce.
Yeah. And it's also derivative of, everything is about sales, right? So look at foreign sales and say this actress is not as valuable as this actor because of the sales at times. But really, you have to flip it around. Once you start paying people equally, you have to start that movement and reverse that trend, because they are... then you're featuring people in a more highlighted way in your movies. Therefore, they'll have more value. They'll be in more movies, and it changes the perception.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense, you know. So this is still going on in Hollywood. You're saying, now, even if the female lead can bring in more money to the film than a guy, would she still...
Yeah, I mean, I think there are outliers. There are people that are, of course, wonderful stars, and they have value, and they should be paid what they get paid. I think it's hard because a lot of the times the supporting cast will be paid less. The female will be paid less than her male counterpart. And, our mission in the company was to say, look, we're going to pay Juan Acosta and Juan Pablo Rava equal, because they're main characters in this movie. And that's our mission for every movie we do, is that we're going to make sure that everyone's compensated appropriately, because we're working on this together, and it does take risk, because sometimes it's not the best financial investment initially, but we hope that it helps at least move the trend in another direction.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to resolve to the fact that this is what it's going to cost.
Yeah.
And you can't budget it by saying, you know, I'm going to pay less the female when you don't even have a good reason to do so.
Right. The reason is we can get away with it.
Yeah.
Right? That's the reason, is that we have a great opportunity for any actress we're going to negotiate down, and we negotiated up.
At least you can sleep well at night.
Yeah.
Right?
We hope people steal the model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, in a nutshell, the story of Imprisoned, right? Yeah. And who played the lead again? Did you say?
Yeah, Juana Acosta is the female lead. Juan Pablo Raba is our male lead. And Dylan, and then Lawrence Fishburne is the...
So these are the three main characters.
Three main characters. Much. And then Edward James Olmos, Isai Morales, and John Huertes are our supporting cast around it. And then they bring amazing work in the time they're on screen, yeah.
Right. And now I watched the trailer, and apparently this movie is takes place in prison.
Yeah.
Some of it, right?
Yeah, yeah. It moves between this sort of freedom of the ocean in Puerto Rico and fishing to being incarcerated. So the way the movie's set, you're in a prison and you see out the bars to an ocean of freedom,
but you
can't get out.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really
the worst thing that could happen, right?
And that's really where the movie kind of lies. Is you might be 20 feet from freedom, and once this prison warden pulls you into the system, you can see it, but you can never touch it again.
Jeez.
Yeah, so.
How depressing can that be, right?
Well, yeah, it has a weight to it, that's for sure.
Yeah. What was the, so the guy initially, why was he in prison in the first place?
He had, I won't give so much away, but he had done something in his youth accidentally, but he was a part of it, and someone was injured because of it, and went to prison and turned his life around, and through the love and support of his wife, he saw a new way of living and now spends his time on his fishing boat. He hires only incarcerated men and gives them an opportunity. And that's what he's doing to sort of pay his penance back.
Yeah.
And once he feels like he's living a great life, and then it just turns out this new prison warden is connected to his past and he can't let it go.
Right.
And it becomes a love triangle in some ways between the warden and Dylan and his wife, a small, intense triangle set in a big movie that ends up in a big prison riot. Yeah, so
really?
I'll give a little bit away.
Jeez.
So
that's okay though, because I mean this makes it more compelling for me to see now.
Because
you're saying a love triangle now this is like a whole thing.
It's dark and it has a lot of complicated emotions, but you root for people to rise up and in the movie. The Dylan's wife Maria she's very powerless to what's happening in her life, so she rallies the people to rise up and protest against the government and ends up changing policy, which was very ironic because that's what happened in Puerto Rico. They rose up, changed the governor. So when we premiered in Puerto Rico, so many of the people that we work with on the film were watching it and saying, "This is what we did." We had a million people march in the streets and. So what we do in this movie is rise people up to protest.
Right. And I understand you actually used real prisoners in the movie,
so that's a great thing. We went down there as part of our mission. I worked with a lot of incarcerated men in the prison system and some who had been out, and we cast 40 men who are in the movie that were formerly incarcerated.
Uh-huh.
So when people see the movie, everyone in that prison is someone who's done some serious time but has turned their life around. And then what we did was really astonishing. When we went back to Puerto Rico, the government gave us a space, and they brought in five prisons, and we screened the movie for 1,000 men and women who are behind the prison walls now. So they are very progressive in Puerto Rico in terms of the rehabilitation. So they allowed 1,000 men and women to sit outside and watch a movie about a prison riot. In a prison, and it was really astonishing. But what was really wonderful is three men in the prison watching the movie are in the movie. So it was very moving to see them see themselves on the screen and to see how everyone supported them.
And so these are former prisoners that are now acting.
Yeah. So there are 40 of them that were in the movie that were formerly incarcerated. I want to clarify something. I cast 10 men who were currently in prison in the movie, and three of those 10 are still in prison.
Oh, they're still in.
So none of those men went back. Those were men that were in there.
Right.
But one of our supporting characters in the movie was not an actor, and he was an advisor for us, and I really thought he was right for the film, and I gave him a role in the movie, and it changed his life. And now he's done 3 or 4 films since then. He was in Puerto Rico on a panel discussion with us. But we really put our mission into action.
Yeah. Now, the character in the movie, the main character, how many years was he in prison?
He was in prison about 12 years.
12 years?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he's married. Was he married before, after, no. during?
So, right. So the sort of basic backstory leading to it is that the woman he married met him in the prison system and helped him turn his life around when he got out. They got married, and they've been together, married about 5 years, and their life is moving, and they live in a nice little house in Puerto Rico, and she owns a coffee shop, and everything's great
one day something happens.
Until the prison warden
shows
up.
Man. You never know where it's going to hit you from, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Jeez. Sounds pretty cool. Now, you want to give a shout out to some of the people that closest, that worked with you? And I mean, you've done a lot of things, obviously, but nobody can do something like this alone.
Yeah, I want to, you know, I mentioned all of the actors that people recognize. I also want to acknowledge, you know, my one of the actors in the film, Vic Palizzo's, Christopher John Martin, who are wonderful in the film, and I think they're going to be there tonight. My DP, Renee Young, who's the person I mentioned I've worked with, you know, he's sort of been my partner in crime for 15 years now.
Really? How did you guys meet?
Where I was editing my first movie was in a facility that he owned, and I would run into him in the cafe area and in the kitchen. And I saw photos of him with cameras, and I thought, oh, he must be a director of photography. And and then when I had this idea for a film, this little film, I approached him, and he said, you know, what the heck, let's do it. And that's how we met. And he's been on this journey with me, you know, for a long, long time, and it's been really great. So
nice.
A shout out to him, and you know, yeah, and so that, I would mention that as well. And Cinema Libre is our distributor on the film. They came on, they saw the film and really loved it. So, you know, they have a very socially driven mission as well in terms of releasing films that have a purpose. So it was a nice match, and they're helping us get this movie across the country.
Yeah, and are you planning anything? Like a sequel or something for this, or does this pretty much have a solid ending?
Yeah, this has an ending, but it's funny you ask that. I've actually been having conversations with some people about a prequel, because life of this young character and this woman that meets him 15 years ago is a beautiful story of someone's changing their life in the prison system. So we're thinking about it, or I'm at least contemplating it now. We'll see if I want to go in that direction, but. We had a lot of inquiries in Puerto Rico about what happened before and how that's a really strong story. And so, you know, we're looking at all those potentials.
Yeah. How did the story come to you, though? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, did you have any kind of experience with the correctional system?
No, other than my experience in the, you know, doing some work in Cook County, I really wish I'm always been intrigued by large stories about hope and redemption and, you know, these big themes, but how to make it personal. So I thought, well, you know, what if this main character of the story, this prison warden, is actually someone who's a good person trying to do the right thing, but his personal hatred, his personal demons catch up with him. So that corruption to me was a big idea of someone who's a main pillar of the community that's trying to do the right thing, but his own personal demons catch up with him. So that's sort of where it sort of evolved from. It's a little bit Shakespearean in some ways, because no character is black and white. Everyone in this movie is our lead character who's turned his life around. People realize he did bad things in his past, and this character that is played by Lawrence Fishburne, who's doing these bad things now, you understand why.
Right.
And audiences that we've talked to have been really, really angered and torn, because they side with both arguments, and I think that's good, because it allows people to have a conversation.
It really does, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, it's not black and white.
Jeez,
very cool. And I don't know, man, when I think of prison, that really scares me. That is like my biggest nightmare, you know. Is prison, because to me freedom is so important. You know. And so you actually took most of the of the cast from Puerto Rico, right?
Yep.
So you didn't have to fly everybody over,
right?
There,
we brought over our main cast that I mentioned, but everyone else we cast out of Puerto Rico.
That's cool.
One of the supporting leads, Francis Rosa, is plays the nephew with the warden, Lawrence Fishburne's nephew. He's wonderful in the movie. And then all of the rest of the supporting cast are all Puerto Ricans. The whole crew is Puerto Rican, and we were the last film to shoot in Puerto Rico before the hurricane. So it was wonderful to bring the film back right. after everything and show it, you know, premiere it there before we take it across the country.
Right. Does their government help you in any way when you make films there?
Yeah, so the Puerto Rican Film Commission is really, really progressive and wonderful. It's one of the industries, as everyone knows, Puerto Rico has a lot of financial issues and with the hurricane, but they have tax credits that help entice filmmakers to come in. And they're one of the most progressive, and it's been probably one of the most successful endeavors in Puerto Rico is the film initiative. There are other incentives, but the film initiative has been very successful. So I'm a big proponent of not only films that I'm involved with in Puerto Rico, but to try to entice people listening to look at Puerto Rico. When you look at Georgia and other places that have tax incentives, Puerto Rico's higher. And my company, Equitas Entertainment, is involved deeply in Puerto Rico, and we're helping facilitate other projects to be shot there.
Right. And they've got great locations, too.
It's beautiful. I mean, a lot of times, there's a lot of movies that people will see that are Miami or other places that were really shot in Puerto Rico.
Really?
And because you can double it for so many places, because it's a city and it has an island feel to it, and then it has desert, and it has, you know, it's really a small place that can be many different locations. But just, we show Puerto Rico for being Puerto Rico. We right. see the island, we see the landmarks, we see the ocean. And when we showed it there, the film commissioner said he was very moved by the movie and said, this is one of the few movies shot here in the last 10 years that actually embraces Puerto Rico. And we're very proud of that.
Wow, very yeah. cool, man. Yeah. Did you go into the film circuits too, the festival circuits?
No, we've taken this film to premiere, and now we're taking out theatrically. We might present it at some festivals coming up, but we wanted to take it out because of our mission, trying to make a difference, trying right. to use the film to call attention to the equal pay and some of the social impact initiatives. So we're working with an organization called peacelove.org, and they're very big in the mental health space. Mm. And one of the avenues they work very strongly in is the prison system. So we partnered with them, and every city that we open the movie in, we are making a donation to further their organization in that city. So mm. as we open across the country, peacelove.org will be supported by Equitas, and they will be able to help not only in the prison systems, but in all other aspects of mental health
yeah.
through the arts.
Now, making the movie, did you discover anything that's like wrong with the system, with the justice system?
Well, you know, you almost can't avoid people telling you stories, right? People who've been through the system on both sides. One of the things that's really important and that I find very, very universal is that the people in the prison system, as incarcerated or guards, they're all in the same prison. They're all part of the job every day.
Right.
So you really see how it's a negotiation of interaction and social commerce, that it isn't just a, you know, you're on one side of the bar, I'm on the other. You live together. You literally
That's
spend
true.
8
That's
to
true.
12, 15
you
hours
You know
a day.
Each other pretty well.
Right. And that's yeah. also one of the reasons why there tends to be so much corruption in the prison system, is the way you get things done is you need mm. someone on the outside who can help you. And sometimes that's a positive thing. Sometimes, of course, there's a lot of drugs and commerce being moved through the prison system. But a lot of, you know, really what I discovered in making this movie and also talking to correctional institutions around the country is that, you know, our country is very heavy in punitive punishment. Mm. And it's not as focused on rehabilitation.
I see.
Because it's an industry, right? It's an industry of filling jail cells. There's money coming in. It's privatized. So it is a real industry that makes a lot of money for people. And there really is not an incentive to change the system. Definitely people make mistakes. They need to pay for those mistakes. I'm not saying we need to get rid of the system, but we need to really look at countries like Germany and Norway and Sweden, who look at how do you plan on integrating people when they leave back into the community, because without that integration, you're forcing them back into the system.
That's
there's,
true,
there's
right?
No opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but I can see the point of punishing someone, you know, as a deterrent.
Absolutely.
Things like that. But you're right. I mean, we have to think long term.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen to that person when he leaves? You know,
yeah.
if we don't rehabilitate them, they're going to be dangerous to the public.
The big story, the character I mentioned in this movie, this actor, Nathaniel, who plays Lobo, he was done 15 years in a strong prison system in Puerto Rico, came out, went back to school, got his master's degree, couldn't get a job. No one would hire him because of his past. And he was coming as our prison advisor, and we were paying him every day. He would drive an hour just to come in for a job. But once we cast him in the movie, I think just doing a week on this movie, he probably made more money than a full year prior. And now it's given him an opportunity to work in other films and to me, that's really important because we all at some point could have or have taken turns that people don't know about.
Yeah.
And the people that tend to make mistakes, we want them to pay their debt. But there is a reason you pay your debt, and that you come out and you, if you don't have a way to integrate, you are really creating almost another opportunity for more crime because you have to survive.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to imagine being in prison. Like I said, I don't even want to think about it. It's like, you
yeah.
know,
yeah,
like snakes for me. Why do people put up snake pictures all the time, you know, on social media and stuff? I'm like, come on, man. I don't want to look at this. Some people make their brand, you know, their logo with a snake. I'm like, what the hell are you doing, you know? Well, it's cartoonish, but still.
Yeah.
At any rate, Paul Kampf, the prison is, the prison, the movie is imprisoned.
Yeah.
And is it going to be available, like you think, on streaming services?
Yeah,
is
yeah, absolutely. The goal? Yeah, we'll be running through theatrically here with Cinema Libre. We'll be in New York. We're in New York, LA. Then we're opening Chicago. We're going to be looking at opening in Portland and Orlando and Dallas and other cities. And then once it builds its theatrical run to a completion, then it will be on a stream service. But it'll be opening in Europe, I think, in October, November theatrically. So we have a whole other push for Europe. But, you know, it's an independent film, and as everyone looks around this town, there's thousands and thousands of movies coming out every moment. So we're hoping that people will come out and support this film. They'll see a unique piece of storytelling with amazing performances in it. And hopefully, you know, get behind what we're trying to do to make a difference with equal pay and social impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the movie is worth seeing, and I'm looking forward to seeing it now. So people can see it today.
Yeah, yeah. Please come out.
And when else can they see it?
Yeah. So it runs a regular run at Lemley Theater in Music Hall in Beverly Hills, as well as Lakewood, California. You can go to Lemley's website and buy tickets online and come.
And that's for how long? A week or so?
It's going to start out for the first week, and then as we have support, knock on wood, this first weekend, then we extend and we just keep extending the runs and maybe add more theaters if we get the audience response. But you know, a lot of people, I'm sure, listening to this know what it's like. There are a lot of people are in the industry, and that, you know, you're pushing people to come out and support it. But this weekend's important because we have the opening weekend says a lot about what trends will happen. And that's why I'm there to do talkbacks tonight and tomorrow and the evening performances and be available to answer questions after the movie.
That's cool. If you have any more strength to talk about the movie, I mean, after an hour here, man, we dried you out completely.
I appreciate it.
But thank you for coming, Paul. We really appreciate this. Yeah. Everybody, check it out. If you're in LA, you can go see it. And then you said in New York also. And
I think it just completed its run in New York. But you can go to the Imprisoned Movie on Facebook or theimprisonedmovie.com. Find us. Reach out to us. We'll get you information about where you can see the movie. And you can also read a lot about our social impact and our partnerships through our website and our social media.
Sounds good, man. Well, you're a very inspiring man,
well, thank
I got to
so
tell
much.
You. You've done so much, and you're very creative, and you've shown that, you know, if people are not going to, I mean, not that people are not going to hire you, but I think it's better when you come up with your own stuff, you know, then you're your own boss.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I'm saying. I mean, to me, it's like I can be hired for a million things, but I don't want to. I want to have my own thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I salute you for that. And
thank
I
you.
Know that it's not easy. I never could wrap my mind around how feature films are being made when there's so much involved, you know, so much.
Yeah.
And even in your film, you don't really have special effects and stuff that you don't need, really, I mean, to tell the story.
Yeah, it should look like a big, you know, an audience will see it and think it's hopefully a big studio film or have that potential, and then they'll realize we did it independently. We, you know, did it all ourselves in under 30 days.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you submit it to competition and stuff too?
We haven't done that yet. We're taking out theatrically, but you know, after that, we might show it at special festivals or have some special screenings in Europe, especially because of maybe in Spain because of one of the blended language.
Right,
we might show it there.
But I'm talking about like Oscars and things like this.
Well, you I think you submit, and then you I think we have people coming out from the from the various award categories, and then they make their decision. We don't really have the push out now to buy the billboards and push. But if everyone in listening comes out and buys a ticket, we might have a shot.
There you go.
Thank you.
All right, Paul Kemp, thank you so much for
joining us.
Much success to you, and please come back and with your future projects and everything. You're always welcome. And Rachel, thank you as always. Thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you on Monday.
Listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.